The Teaching Saints Virtual Summit was an incredible success. We had thousands of individuals tune in from around the world to hear from people like Brad Wilcox, Hank Smith, Casey Griffiths, Marie Eckersley, Jason Hewlett, Jeff Burke, and more as they taught us about how to better stimulate classroom discussion, create effective classroom environments, best practices with object lessons, and so much more. If you missed the summit, be sure to visit leadinglds.org/teach to watch the three most viewed sessions from the online conference. It will not only change you, but it will change those you teach. Check out the Teaching Saints Virtual Summit today. Leading LDS is a nonprofit organization dedicated to enhancing leadership ability and capacity of lay leaders in order to accelerate the mission of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Leading LDS is not owned nor operated by the LDS Church, and any opinions expressed on this podcast do not reflect the views of any specific organization. All donations given to Leading LDS are tax deductible and go towards the support of Leading LDS. For more information, visit leadinglds.org.
My name is Paul Kruger from Cape Town, South Africa. As a convert to the church, the information available on Leading LDS has fast-forwarded my knowledge of serving in the church. I love listening to the podcast on Leading LDS, which is so spiritually uplifting. I know about the loneliness of leadership and how I need this information to guide me through my days. It's amazing how blessed we are as members of the church to not only have to work during the week to make a living and then again on weekends just to get better ourselves. One of my favorite podcasts is the one with Elder Groberg, so much so that I watched this movie, The Other Side of Heaven, a few times now. People like him just keep on giving and giving of himself without expecting any rewards. This has motivated me to raise my own bar. I'm super excited with Kurt's book, A Culture of Ministering, which we will shortly use as part of training our relief societies and elders' quorums. Leading LDS truly helped me to be a leader, not a calling.
Hey everyone, this is Kurt Frankum with the Leading LDS Podcast. I will be your host. Now, this interview is one I'm excited to share with you. You know, I feel honored that I could be involved in this interview and do it. But at the same time, it's a heavy subject, and I often wonder why I get myself into these interviews, because I am the last person qualified to handle something like this. But I hope, we always start our interviews with prayer, and I definitely need it this time. So hopefully I handle it all okay. I had the opportunity to interview Bishop Jim Hastings from Dallas, Texas. And Jim is a wonderful bishop and has served for 3 years or so now, and has been doing a great job. His Elderscorn president recently reached out to me and actually introduced us and connected us. And now that's what led to this interview. And the topic of this interview is when tragedy strikes the bishop, or when tragedy strikes the leader. Because Jim lost his sweet daughter, Zoe, who was 19 years old, who was abducted and murdered in Dallas. Just a tragic, tragic experience, and one that I wish didn't happen in this world, but unfortunately it does. And so we talk about that. We talk about the story, building some context about what happened, and then how he responded, how he was able to manage his duties as bishop and continue serving, and what a blessing that was in his life. Now, we also talk about forgiveness and the dynamics of forgiveness when something so horrible happens. And obviously, we're commanded to forgive, but when we're in the thick of it and somebody's taken something so precious, it's not an overnight thing. It's not a black and white thing, right? And so I just really benefited from this discussion. And he also shares his time conducting 15 or so funerals as a bishop, some of his processes that he's done that's really helped him help others get through the loss of a loved one. So buckle up. It's a good one. I hope you share it. It's a story that needs to be shared, and especially with leaders who have a lot coming at them. And I know there's probably individuals who are listening to this in the future from recording this interview that maybe lost a loved one through a tragic experience like this. And I hope this interview brings some peace to your heart as you hear from others that have maybe gone through something similar. I sure hope it will. So here's my interview with Bishop Jim Hastings in Dallas, Texas. Today, we're headed down to Dallas, Texas to talk with Bishop Jim Hastings. How are you, Jim?
I'm doing good. Thanks.
Nice, or bishop, or Brother Hastings, or, you know, we have all sorts of titles and names in this church. But sure. What would you like to be called for the next hour?
Jim is fine.
Okay, we'll go with Jim. That's great. Yeah. Now, Jim, you were brought to my attention by, I believe it was your Elders Quorum president, or maybe he's not your Elders Quorum president anymore.
He is.
So he emailed me, and as I often do on the podcast, as I say, anybody out there have connection to fantastic leaders, maybe interesting stories that I should reach out to? And he sent me an email, and here we are talking, and I'm excited to hear about your story and to see what we can learn from your experience. And it's a heavy one, unfortunately, but nonetheless, I think it's worth talking about and discussing. Sure. So, Jim, maybe just in a couple of minutes, what's your background? What do people need to know about you to put you into context?
Well, I've been a member of the church my whole life. Both my parents were members, and my mom's side goes back to pioneers crossing the plains and coming over from Europe originally. So I have a lot of, most of my family is members of the church. My wife's family is members of the church. I've been married for 23 years. I have 5 children, and I've been a bishop for the last little over 3 years now.
Oh, great. So you're about at the halftime break, right?
Yeah, right.
Who knows? Who knows? That's great. Now we did do a little video chat before we started recording, and you have a big, beautiful beard. So I mean, this is a cultural thing with the church that you know, the old rumor is that bishops can't have beards, but nowhere in the handbooks does it say that. So what's the story behind that?
I've had a beard since I got married, really.
You're just a beard guy.
Yeah, no, I mean, I grew a beard out about 21, 22 years ago, and I've just always had one. And I got called into the bishopric 6 years ago with a former bishop, and he had a goatee, and he did not mind me having a beard, and neither did the stake president. And so I kept it. It's just something I like having. And
awesome. Awesome. Well, good for you.
Yeah.
We need more bearded bishops, in my opinion, anyway. So was it a point of discussion when you were first called? Did you ask if you could keep it?
I didn't even ask. I just went in and interviewed, and it was a non-issue. So,
oh, good. Assume the sale. That always is good. That's cool. So, what do you remember from that time when you were called as bishop? Did it blindside you, or what do you remember?
Well, the bishop that I was serving with, he had had a job change and was going. He was moving to Peru for 3 years, and taking his family. And I had been serving as first counselor. So, I mean, I knew there was a chance that I'd get called as bishop. Obviously, I didn't know, but it was a great experience. I really love our stake presidency, and you know, they're just the kind of guys that you go in and you feel like really comfortable talking to them about everything. And you know, even as a counselor before I was bishop, I would go in and talk to them, you know, after meetings or other things. And sometimes I'd come in kind of feeling weighed down, and I always left feeling lighter. So when I got called as a bishop, I was really excited to serve with the stake presidency that's still currently in. I mean, they're really inspiring men for me. Hmm.
That's great. Yeah. As you think back the 3 years you've been serving now, how would you define the progression you've made personally as a leader? Anything stand out or over those years?
I think I've learned how to be patient and not expect things to happen right away. Certainly in my own life, but also when I'm talking to other people, you know, I think that I've learned how to really listen to people and seek out the Heavenly Father's guidance as to what I'm supposed to do. And that guidance, you know, as you know, having been a bishop, it varies from one person to the next. So I think just learning a lot of patience to figure out what it is I'm supposed to be doing and then do it.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, I do a lot of these How I Lead interviews where we really dig into maybe some leadership principles and an individual's experience as a leader. And this interview is going to be a little different. So I don't mean to throw those, you know, deep, thoughtful questions at you, but
sure. No, it's all right.
what I really wanted to talk about, Christian, your Elders Quorum president originally brought up, was that your family's faced quite a bit of tragedy. And with, I guess, the abduction and murder of your daughter. And I mean, I cannot even begin to imagine, and I have no place to even be the guy doing the interview about about such a tragic event. I hope I treat it with respect, and hopefully we can learn things from that. But also, as we've talked leading up to this interview, you have dealt with all levels of loss and death in your life, some to the most tragic, like your daughters, to very sudden with losing parents to cancer in a matter of weeks. And then you've had, I think you told me, about 15 plus funerals in your ward. And so I think there's a lot of questions I have in the context of tragedy, and not only, you know, handling tragedy in a ward, but in a personal life, especially as you're serving as a leader. So let's go back to the first story. Tell us about your daughter. I think she was 19, if I remember, when she passed away. And but create some context around her. What type of individual was she, and leading up to the tragedy that happened?
Yeah, sure. So she, very outgoing. You know, as far as my kids go, she has by far been the most outgoing kid. She has some younger sisters that are definitely coming up on her heels as far as that's concerned, but real creative. You know, I'm an artist, and she's grown up going to museums and talking about art and being around art and going to plays and just doing a lot of culturally, I guess, significant things as she grew up. And so that was really important to her. When she went to high school, she auditioned and got into Booker T. Washington, which is our performing and visual arts magnet school. It's in downtown Dallas. Probably the closest comparison could be like to the Fame School in New York, but it's focused just on the performing and visual arts. And so kids do academics, but you know, that's kind of the focus. So she went in for that with art. She did a 20-piece portfolio before her ninth grade year, auditioned, and she got in for art. And then after being there for about a year, she saw that what the theater kids were doing was what she really wanted to do. And so she gave up her spot in art and she re-auditioned for theater, which they only had one spot for, and she got it. So, Yeah. So she spent the next 3 years doing theater, and she was an actress for the most part. So, you know, real creative, very thoughtful person. You know, I mean, she was always interested in like finding out about people that you wouldn't normally think of. Like, for instance, our mailman. She, about 3 or 4 days before she died, she had left a questionnaire out on her porch for our mailman. And it was like, I don't know your name. What's your name? You know, what are some things you like candy bars and this kind of thing? And she basically was trying to come up with a care package for him because she thought, you know, mailmen didn't really get recognized.
The unsung heroes of our society.
Right, exactly. So I think that's a pretty accurate view of the kind of person she was. She was very involved in church activity. You know, she was a stake youth leader and you know, leader in young women. And she was really, from the time she was probably about 7 or 8 years old, had wanted to go on a mission. And she, you know, mission was really important to me. And I talked a lot about it when she was a little kid and as she grew up as well, but I was a little closer to my mission when she was small. And she just always wanted to go on a mission. And so I think that as she got closer to the end of high school, she was a little concerned that, you know, man, can I wait till I'm 21 to do this? And then the age changed for girls. And that was like, there was no doubt she was going at that point. You know, I mean, she's like, this is what I'm going to do. So.
And her name was Zoe, right?
Yes.
And so it sounds like huge spiritual giant, very creative. I mean, she sounded like a girl that it was not difficult to be proud of.
Oh yeah. No, she was just a really good person.
So, and I don't know if you need to go into all the gruesome details of what happened, but maybe just build some context about what happened with her abduction and murder.
Yeah, sure. So she had been attending the missionary prep classes on Sunday night up at our stake center, which is where we attend church. And she left to go to one of the meetings. I was actually on my way home from church after meeting with people, and I missed her that day. I didn't really see her the last day, because I was up and at church before anyone in the house was awake, and I didn't get back until after. And anyways, she had left to go to the meeting. We have like a pharmacy right across the street, and she stopped there to return a Redbox movie. And when she was coming back to her car, there was a guy that basically pushed her in, kidnapped her, and then he drove her, I don't know, about a block away from our church for whatever reason. It was kind of a wooded area, and he killed her. Mm-hmm. So.
And then how did this, what transpired as that, as far as you getting the news of what's happened? Or first, I imagine there was some time you just thought she was missing.
Yeah. Well, I got home right after she had left, and we have a lot of family that lives in the area, or we did at the time. And so every Sunday we had dinner together, and that week we were having it at my house. And so I had most of the family over for dinner that night. And anyways, you know, Zoe would usually go to the mission prep class, and then she would come back pretty quickly, and she didn't get back. And we thought, well, you know, maybe she was hanging out with some people from the class and talking or whatever. And after about 2 hours, you know, we started calling her, and she wasn't responding to phone calls, texting her. She wasn't responding to that. So me and my brother-in-law, we drove over to the church, and there was nobody there. And she had been attending the singles ward, which was in another building, and it was closer to downtown. And so we drove over there to go see if she might be there. There was nobody there. I would say probably around 10 o'clock that night, we really, really started getting worried, because we just, you know, she always responded when we either, I mean, maybe not right that second, you know, but she would respond, you know, pretty quickly. And so I called the police around 10 and reported her missing. And because she was an older teenager, they were like, well, you know, could you think she's just out with some friends? And I said, well, this is really uncharacteristic for her. I don't think that's what's going on here. And they said, well, we'll send somebody out. And so we waited for about 2 hours until midnight. And nobody showed up. And so I got in the car, and I called my brother, and I told him what was going on. And he and my sister started driving around looking for her. And I drove over to the police station and reported her missing. And
let me just interject here with a question. I mean, in my life as a father, you know, my oldest is 6, and I have a 3-year-old boy as well. And you know, sometimes we're at the park, and it's like they're missing for 5 minutes, and my mind is jumping to every like worst case scenario. Sure. Was there a lot of self talk, sort of trying to calm yourself down? Like, listen, there's just probably a misunderstanding, or at what point were you did you really feel like, wow, this is just completely out of character for her?
Yeah, I think that around 10 o'clock, when we hadn't heard from her, that's when I started worrying. And certainly by midnight, when I got to the police station, I knew that there was something wrong, and I didn't know exactly what it was. And I don't know that I really jumped to any conclusions other than maybe she'd had a bad day and needed time to herself, you know, or something like that. And, so, I mean, but we spent pretty much the whole night driving around the city looking for her. And, I called one of my cousins who was good with computers. And we had been trying to get her phone to come up on her Find the iPhone app, and it just wasn't coming up. And, you know, like my wife's phone and my phone and our iPad, you know, all those things were kind of coming up on it, but her phone would not. So my cousin came over about 8 o'clock in the morning, and he got on the computer, and within 5 minutes he got her phone to ding. And we knew exactly where the location was. I mean, as soon as we saw it on the map, we knew where it was. And, you know, we kind of all jumped in the truck and we drove down the street basically to where she was. And as we were pulling up, there was a fire truck and a couple police cars and an ambulance. And, you know, of course, you know, at that point we were terrified because we knew something terrible had happened. There's even reporters that were there before us. I don't even know how that happened, but you know, there were people. There was 2 or 3 cameras there with reporters as we pulled up. And I mean, we had just found out. I don't think they had even really realized what was going on yet.
And so did a passerby come upon her body, or what? How were they alerted of it?
Well, they had a man who was just out for a walk that morning. He saw her and it scared him half to death. You know, he knew something. Her van had been, or our van had been driven into a ditch, basically. It was kind of nose first into this creek, and I think he could kind of see our daughter, but it scared him, and he kind of ran out into the neighborhood trying to find somebody that could help. And interesting thing was, is that the person that he ran into were people I knew. They were, it was a dad and his daughter who were going to school, and the daughter I had taught for years. She was one of my students, and the dad knew me as well. And they went over and they found her and called the police.
So, yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
And then, so you basically get out of the car, and you know, I would imagine police officers notify you what's happened. And that's when the reality of your situation is looks you right in the face.
Yeah. Yeah. It was, we didn't know what happened, and it took about an hour before detectives finally were able to see kind of what had gone on and came over and talked to us. So we just basically waited behind the police tape until they came and told us what was happening. Yeah. But of course we kind of knew.
Sure. And so, and I would imagine, I mean, the police officers, they get pretty much to the point as far as, you know, they stick with the facts and tell you what's happened, what they found. And
yeah.
And so where do you, I mean, I'm just thinking, obviously we'll talk about the weeks and months after that, but in the next hour after that, like what do you do? How do you even start to think and put sentences together? I mean, how would you describe, and again, I'm not trying to torture you here or bring up these feelings, but to me, it's like, I just, you know, in the context of leadership, when a leader has to give really, really sad, traumatizing news of passing of a loved one or even a tragic death like this.
Yeah.
I'm just curious what state of mind you were in, and I'm sure it's different for everybody.
Yeah. Well, I mean, shock. My wife was mad. You know, I think that, you know, she kind of responds to stress either by laughing or sometimes getting really angry. And she just got really angry. I think that a lot of it was because they wouldn't let us go over there, and we knew our daughter was there, and we had to wait. And that was really, it was difficult, frustrating, you know. It's amazing kind of the people that showed up at that crime scene. My stake president showed up. I mean, he was there like, I don't know. I mean, I don't know how long after we got there he showed up, but it felt like it was maybe 10 or 15 minutes after we got there. I don't know how he knew where we were or what was going on, because I hadn't called him.
Yeah.
And then I started having people from my ward show up. I had a member of our ward that was a police officer. He showed up and he just kind of grabbed onto me and sat down next to me and hugged on me, which was really comforting. And the other thing that was kind of interesting was the crime scene investigator was with the police. Well, the police officer who was investigating the crime and taking all the evidence was a member of the church, and which is really odd. I mean, I know in Salt Lake, you know, you got members everywhere, but that's not really the case.
We're surprised that they aren't a member of the church. Yeah,
yeah. But he had. Several of my friends and like my brother, that because of the situation of where the car was, you could go around to the other side and actually see what was going on if you went over the bridge. And I had one of my friends come over and said, "Hey, you can see what's going on over there." And right about the time he came and said that to me, this good guy, this police officer came over, and he was kind of a short guy. And he said, "You're a member of the church, aren't you?" And I said, "Member of what church?" he said, "You're LDS." And I said, "Yeah." I said, "How'd you know that?" And he said, "Well, there were some things in the car that just tipped me off." I said, "Oh, okay." And he said, "Will you please make me a promise? Don't go over and look at the scene." He said, you'll never be able to forget it." And I'm really grateful that he was there to kind of give me that direction, because that was my intention. And there were just a lot of people there that they were just the right people to be there, because they, in different ways, comforted and kind of just held on to us while we were.
Lots of tender mercies, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know if that answered your question.
No, that absolutely. Absolutely. And I would imagine in those interactions, I mean, most people probably don't know what to say other than give you a hug and express their love for you. Right. And really that's, there's nothing you need more than just that love, because nobody can fix or undo what had just transpired. Right.
Right. And no one, including us, it was a new experience, I think, for everyone involved, except for maybe the police officers, you know.
But yeah. So, and obviously, just to fast forward through the main points of the story, that they maybe just give us the timeline. They did find the individual who committed the murder and has been convicted and sentenced to life in prison. Anything else that would be needed for the context of the story or as we continue on with our discussion?
I don't think so.
Okay.
Other than I think that, you know, surprisingly to me, I think the trial was more stressful than the time after my daughter died. it kind of took me by surprise, but
yeah. And is that mainly due to, I would imagine it becomes sort of a media circus a little bit?
Well, it was, yeah. I mean, I think that was probably one of the most difficult parts of this was, you know, our situation was on the news every night for weeks. Mm-hmm. And there wasn't a person around us that didn't know what was going on. And that was tough. And it was tough being at church, knowing that everybody sitting out in the congregation had a really good idea of what had just transpired in our life.
Yeah. Well, let's go back to, you know, after the episode happened, and maybe the days after that. I mean, you mentioned this being in the state of shock. Mm-hmm. Do you feel sort of that wears off after a few hours? Did it take a week? Because I would imagine after the, you know, a few days after are you questioning everything about life as far as, you know, maybe I'll quit my job. Maybe I'll ask to be released as bishop. Maybe, I mean, I'm just trying to speculate on maybe some thoughts that would go through my head. You know, if this is such a stress. I want to get rid of all other stress in any form. But maybe tell us about how long that shock happened and what sort of state of mind do you go through as you're trying to wake up the next morning and the next one after that and the next one after that?
Yeah. Well, the answer, the waking up the next morning, I don't know that we slept the next night. So there wasn't a lot of waking up. It was just moving from one room in the house to the next. But, you know, I think that the numbness probably wore off or started to wear off a bit after the funeral. It really was good, I think, that we were somewhat numb through that first week of having to plan things out and, you know, plan for the funeral. You know, I spoke at the funeral, so kind of considering what I would say. And
so is this numbness, was it a positive thing? Like you weren't ready to really dive into every last emotion connected to the situation.
Yeah. No, it was definitely a good thing for me because I just, you know, I think that it allowed me to kind of just be present you know, I mean, I certainly had some moments where I needed to escape from all the people that were coming over to our house, but for the most part, I was happy to have everyone there. And to your question about, you know, did this throw things into question, you know, about my life, about, you know, what I should do for work, all that kind of stuff. I didn't go back to work for about a month after my daughter died. And I had planned on going back about 2 weeks after. I figured I'd get the funeral over with and then take a week and then kind of go back. And when I got to that point, I couldn't imagine going and standing up in front of classrooms of kids and teaching, you know? So I stayed out another couple of weeks after that. And, it was the right thing for me to do at least, but you know, something that happened earlier in the year was that about 6 or 7 months before my daughter died, my dad died. And my dad, he had a lot of health issues over the last 5 years or so of his life before he passed. And when he died, he was probably the closest person to me that had ever passed away. And I remember thinking to myself, well, here it is, you know, do I really believe what I believe? And, you know, how is this going to go? And after he died, I got a lot of, you know, I prayed a lot and I got a lot of direction as to what I needed to do personally. One of those things was that I felt like I needed to dress my dad. And I also felt like I needed to speak at his funeral. And, you know, there were a few other things that I felt directed to do, which I did. And I really had a confirmation that my dad was truly in a better place, that he was with the Savior and that he was okay. And that there was a life after this. And I worried about it because it's one thing to believe something in theory, and it's a whole other thing to be faced with it and hope that what you've believed is true, you know?
Yeah.
And so having to deal with that with my dad's death was a real blessing, because when my daughter passed away, I didn't deal with any of that emotion, you know, as far as like, where is she? I knew where she was, but it did leave me to kind of deal with the way in which she left this earth. And so, you know, I've seen a lot of connections since my daughter's passing of ways that Heavenly Father's prepared me for things in my life, and especially things that have happened over the last several years in my life.
Yeah.
So.
Wow. You talk about having a month where you took off from work. Did you, and I'm sure obviously everybody's handled these situations differently, but did you find a need for professional therapy to help you unwind some of these things? And I ask this because when you talk about being numb, did you recognize it as numbness, knowing that a lot of emotion was ahead of you, or that you would need help with maybe untangling? Or did you kind of feel like, oh, this, I guess I'm handling this pretty well?
Yeah. I think that initially I thought I was probably handling it pretty well. we just had so much support from friends and from community and from our whole stake, really. And I felt really blessed to be where I was and with so many people that really, I mean, we had women from our ward that, you know, there was no coordination. There was just several ladies that decided we're going to go over and clean their house every week until we decide they're doing okay, you know? And so that's what they did, you know, but Callie, I forgot the question. Sorry.
And it was a long, convoluted question as well. Did you feel a need to reach out to like a professional therapist? I forget what they call it to talk this through and make sure that you were in a good spot.
No. Okay. Yeah. No. And I guess the reason I was talking about all those people is because, you know, initially I felt like things were okay, you know, and when people did start to subside, go back to their lives, and, you know, I had a lot of thoughts that would come to mind that I just honestly didn't know if it was normal. You know, is this how people usually respond in this sort of situation? And so, yeah, I did. I went and saw a therapist. It was one that was recommended to us by the Dallas Police Department initially. She just happened to be a parent at our kid's school, which was kind of a interesting thing, but she wasn't LDS. And I found that over about maybe 4 months or so that I spent most of the time trying to explain to her why certain things were important to us, you know, and it didn't seem very effective to me. And so I went looking for another person that was LDS and kind of had that baseline of understanding about what we believe. And, you know, like I talked to the first therapist, you know, Zoe is really close to going to the temple and taking her endowments out. And we had the wait time of a year kind of waived, and we were able to go through and do her temple work. I think it was either a month or two after she died, which was really significant for us. And, and then I'm talking to the therapist about it. She's like, well, okay. You know, it wasn't that big a deal to her. You know, she didn't really understand why I was even bringing it up, you know, but those sort of things made it really, for me, it was important to have someone who at least understood where I was coming from.
Yeah, sure. And even else, it may be a different issue. I mean, I guess the point being that if someone does go to a therapist, there needs to be some level they need to jive with that therapist on many different levels, right? And it's okay to maybe try a few out until you find one that you can really start to process some of these feelings with.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that kind of initially, sometimes the feeling is, you know, well, I don't want to hurt their feelings or make them feel like they're, you know, they weren't doing a good job or something. But the thing is that if you're going to see a therapist, it's not for the therapist, it's for you. So it's got to work for you, or you're kind of defeating the purpose of going. You know?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. You mentioned obviously some the awesome support you received from, I would imagine, from ward members, and I'm sure your neighbors and so forth. you know, and you, I know you listened to the other interview I did with John and Troy and the loss of Troy's son. And mm-hmm. we spent some time on what that support looks like, because it's easy, I feel like, for maybe just a random person in your ward to just use the old saying of, well, I'm going to give them some space. You know, they need some space right now. But was that what you needed, or how would you coach somebody who has a neighbor or a fellow ward member going through a traumatic time in their life as far as what they can actually do to support them?
Yeah. We had really good neighbors that are not members of the church. In fact, I don't know that in our immediate location where we live, there's really nobody in our neighborhood right there that's members of the church, but we had a lot of neighbors that reached out to us and offered their homes if we needed a place for family to stay when they came into town. And you know, we have a neighbor that's down the street that brings us flowers on the anniversary of her death every year, which is really nice. You know, I mean, it's good to know that they're thinking about us. But for me, I enjoyed having people around. I don't know that that works for everyone, but, you know, we had people at the house that, you know, they came over, you know, one lady that my dad and I home taught for 20 years, just really sweet woman. You know, she came over and, one day she took the kids to go see movies so they could get out of the house and away from everything. You know, there were several days where she just came and she found a comfortable chair and sat down in the house. And she just, I don't know that she was doing a whole lot except for just being there kind of on call, you know, if we needed something. And that for me was a real comfort. But, you know, we had a lot of family. I have a lot of family that lives real close to us, and, you know, they were protective of us, which was helpful because we had news media coming up to our front door and knocking and trying to get interviews, which we just did not want to do. And that was just almost nonstop for the first week, especially. And so our family kind of go out there and head them off at the pass and keep them away from the house. It was really upsetting to our other kids too. So, I think it was good for our kids too, to have people around, you know, that they, right. I know that they felt, you know, if anything, it took a little bit of the sting away, you know, just uh-huh. having people there to kind of take them to play, especially our younger kids that really did not understand what was going on.
Yeah. And Zoe is the oldest. Is that
yeah.
right?
Yeah. She's the oldest.
What's the ages of your other kids?
Well, now they're, so I have a daughter that's 18 and, my son is 15. I have another daughter that is, almost 12 and, my youngest is 4.
Awesome.
Yeah.
So I'm curious to ask you, I want to go into, some of the, just things that maybe from a leadership, some best practices and practical advice, but obviously when, you know, it's one thing when somebody dies in an accident, you know, accidents happen, tragedy happens, you know, that's part of the world that we live in. It's a whole nother dynamic, obviously, when somebody's uses their free agency to do something so awful.
Yeah.
And, you know, of course, we want to be, you know, we're like you kind of referenced this in the beginning that, you know, when you experience your father's death, sometimes we believe things on paper. And we can stand in a fast and testimony meeting and testify of things. But then when you have to like live it, and then when you have to, you know, really, when some of these things really look you in the face, then you have to really sit down and yourself, well, do I really believe this? Right.
Yeah.
I think those are beneficial experiences. What can you tell us about the process or the principle of forgiveness when it comes to situations like this? And I mean, I cannot even begin to imagine beginning to forgive something like this or what that means, or, you know, it's not just, I'm sure there's different layers of that, but obviously I'm sure that played a role, especially going through the trial and the conviction and the sentencing. What comes to mind when you think of forgiveness in relation to this situation?
Well, you know, I've had people, I think that sometimes when I talk about, especially recently when we went through the trial, there were some people like, oh, I just don't know how you could forgive him. And, you know, and my response is quite honestly, you know, I don't know that I have forgiven him, you know?
Yeah. Sure.
I think that I don't think about him a lot, to be real honest. And for me, that's kind of been my way of handling it, at least to this point, which is, you know, when it first happened and probably the first year, especially after, I don't know that I felt hatred towards the person, this guy, but I felt a lot of sadness when I thought about him. And, you know, I think that as we grow, we started getting closer to the trial and we wouldn't just be seeing the guy on television, which is the only place that we had really seen him up to that point, mm-hmm. but that we would be sitting in the room right behind him for a couple weeks. I spent a lot of time praying. I'll say that, you know, or
yeah,
just that I would have the right frame of mind when I was there. And, you know, I had one day I remember in particular that I was coming home from work, and years ago I kind of took up the habit of exercising several times a week, just going to the gym and, you know, lifting weights or doing whatever. It was a way of kind of de-stressing after especially difficult days in school. And so it's just something that's kind of carried over for the entire time I've been a teacher. And for some reason that morning I got up and I had this guy on my mind and I could not get him out of my head all day. And I thought about, you know, what am I going to do when I actually see this guy, you know, and part of me, if I'm being truly honest, wanted to hurt the guy when I was around him. Mm-hmm. And I know from experience that I can't walk around with those kind of thoughts in my head, you know, that it's counterproductive to me doing anything. And so I thought, well, I'll go to the gym and I'll work out. And, you know, maybe if I get an hour away from thinking about all this stuff, I'll feel better and I can just kind of move on with my day. And so I showed up at the gym or at the YMCA where I go, and I took my two daughters that were with me in and kind of got them into the play area. And I mean, it's really hard to explain how I felt, but probably the closest thing I could say is that I just felt tortured thinking about this guy. And I couldn't even focus enough to go in and exercise. And so I walked back out to my van and I got in the back seat and I closed the side door and I just poured my heart out. And I just asked Heavenly Father to kind of help me have what I need so I could at least stop thinking about the guy. And as soon as I finished the prayer, it was gone. I mean, just the thinking about him, the way I had felt, it was just completely lifted. It was truly a gift, because on my own, I was not able to get rid of the thoughts and feelings that I had had. And I think that the Lord just knew that I just had enough at that point.
Yeah.
And I think that from that point on, I've been able to, I guess, have healthy thoughts about what's going on, you know, not counterproductive, not, you know, how could I beat this guy up or what, you know, that whatever it was that I was thinking at the time, you know, all those kind of thoughts left and they didn't come back and they haven't come back. And so I think that over time, I'll be able to maybe say that I do forgive him, but I don't know that in particular is the way that I feel, you know, at the moment.
I just appreciate you being real, you know, with that perspective, because, you know, well, some could say, well, you're a bishop, you know, you're supposed to go out and stand in front of the media and talk about how you've forgiven this gentleman. And then there's pictures of you guys having lunch, you know, during visiting hours mm-hmm. in the prison or, you know, then that's, but in reality, it's a wrestle, you know, and it's a process. And really, it's hard to even peg down what is even forgiveness in these situations, right? Because it's, and I think that's maybe what you can't even begin to articulate what forgiveness looks like, let alone say, yeah, I've forgiven him, you know, because it's so, there's so many layers to it. But I just appreciate you describing the wrestle that it is, that it's on those days that are really hard. You just had to like go out and fall to your knees ask for some heavenly help to get through that day in relation to this individual who's done so much harm to your family and obviously to your daughter.
Yeah,
I think that's awesome. So what about just being bishop? Like, you know, it's like, yeah, this may have happened and you took a month off of work. I'm sure, I don't know if that month included your church service and responsibilities, but mm-hmm. how do you continue on? It's one thing to continue on just breathing, let alone like being a bishop. So tell us about that dynamic.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because that first therapist that I told you about, when I would talk about some of the responsibilities that I had as a bishop, she's like, well, can't you just kind of take a break from it for a little bit and then you can go back, you know? And I was like, no, that's not really how it works. You know, I said, you don't really get a break, you know, it's, but one of the things that the former bishop told me when I was kind of coming in as bishop was that he said, the way I see being a bishop is that you get, you know, you, sometimes you feel like you're about to drown, you know, you've just got so many things going on and you've got so many people that are struggling and just so much required of you. And then, you know, then the Lord, he kind of eases things up. He, you know, either those people are able to take care of the problems that they have, or at least, you know, they're kind of taken off your shoulders for a little bit. And so, so I guess being a bishop kind of ebbs and flows, you know, you have really busy times and then you have times of reprieve. And, I certainly had that, you know, right after. You know, I was, so my daughter was killed on Sunday night, and then we did all the funeral arrangements. We had the funeral on Saturday, and then I was at church on Sunday. And I think I just stayed for sacrament meeting, maybe the first couple weeks after that. And I have really good counselors, and they kind of just, they took care of things for me for a few weeks, at least as far as like Sundays went and different things that were going on. But it was really hard to go back and sit up on the stand, you know, because I already felt like I had had every news media outlet in the area trying to get us on camera. And then there I was kind of on display for the ward, you know, and that was kind of tough. But the real blessing of being a bishop is that people do still need assistance and they do still need counsel, and other people's problems don't stop because you have things going on in your life. And that for me was a real blessing. It was really, I think it really saved my life after all that happened, because, you know, I had to go out and see people, and I had to go out and check on individuals that were struggling, and I had to talk to people about their problems. And I think a lot of people kind of backed off for a while, and they really felt like, and I had people tell me this a little bit later on, that, you know, nothing they had going on in their life compared to what was going on in my life, you know, so why would they come in and talk to me? You know, they just didn't feel like that was even fair. But I think over time people realized that that's what I was there for. And I was, you know, I was given added strength to kind of shoulder the different responsibilities that I had. And ultimately, I mean, that's really what's helped me kind of come out on the other side of it, you know. And I'm not saying that I'm completely on the other side of it, but
yeah,
but I'm certainly further away from it now.
And you can function,
yeah,
as a typical citizen in the world,
right? Right. But you know, but I'm really grateful that I was bishop, and I don't think that I never had the thought that I need to be released. And I think mostly because I felt like I need the blessings that come from this calling, you know. maybe it was a little bit selfish, you know, but I needed to serve people, and I needed to get outside of my own head, and being a bishop is really good at doing that for you.
And I assume your stake president never brought it up either. Did he ever ask you if you should be released?
No, he didn't.
If you wanted to be?
I mean, I think that he kept a real close eye on me, make sure I was doing okay.
Yeah.
You know, one of his counselors has really befriended me over the last several years, and we go out and get dinner pretty regularly. And, you know, I think that in different ways, they've kind of just kept an eye to make sure I'm doing okay. And not so much because they thought maybe I would explode or something, but that they just wanted to make sure I was doing okay, you know. And if there was anything that was kind of apparent that I was being overloaded or I couldn't handle, that it would just be on top of it. So, yeah, no, they never asked me if I wanted to be released or anything like that.
Yeah. And that's, you know, that's such a strong principle that I've interviewed various people that maybe have gone through difficult trials or tragedies, that sometimes the best medicine is simply serving other people, right? And when being a bishop is sort of, you sort of have that built-in package of, you didn't have to think how to serve. It was just like, oh yeah, I have a lineup of appointments of people needing help. I guess I'll go do that. And by doing that, that was a great blessing in your life.
Yeah. Well, and we had a state conference shortly after my daughter died, and the state president had asked me to speak, and I did. And one of the things that kind of came up, at least in my preparing for that talk, was the same day that my daughter was killed, there was another man that was killed, like literally a mile away from her. And
oh my goodness!
Yeah, he was jogging, and he was killed. Yeah, there was a man that came, just kind of lost it and killed him. And those were kind of the two big stories, you know, like from that week. It was pretty heavy. And this other man that had been killed, he didn't have any family, but he was married, and it had apparently a very loving relationship with his wife. And we kind of overlapped a little bit for a little while because she would be up at the police station for different things, and so would we. And we were kind of hearing about what was happening in their case at the same time we were getting information about what was going on in ours. And I think 3 or 4 days after her husband was killed, she committed suicide. And she was so devastated by the loss of her husband that she just didn't know how to deal with it. And I felt such gratitude that I had been given tools to help me deal with the stresses and the sadness that I felt. And it's just not available. Oh, I mean, it is available to everyone, but not everybody has it, you know? And it was a very stark contrast to what was happening with us, you know, to have that happen in that same kind of period of time. And I think that for me, it was a very good reminder of what the gospel does for us, which is it helps us to handle pressures that we face in life, whatever they are, whether they're real heavy or if they're just, you know, things that most people would think are minor. I mean, that's what the gospel is there to do, is to help us with our trials and help us to continue moving forward and not just go, I don't know what to do now, and that's it.
Wow. Well, just curious, has anything changed as far as, and maybe there has been circumstances where you've had to deliver bad news to somebody as a bishop or just help somebody through a trial, right? Regardless if it's tragic or not. I mean, I guess all trials are tragic to some degree, but what have you learned from this that maybe we could learn from as far as approaching an individual going through such a traumatic process?
I think not making an assumption that you know what's going on is important. You know, I mean, regardless of how similar a person's situation might be to your own, everyone has factors that are playing out in their own life that affect the way that they respond to things. And I think I've learned how to listen to people, have them come in and just tell me what's going on in their life. And, you know, and I think that before I talk to people, and this is just kind of my practice, and I'm sure I'm not alone in this, but I always kneel down and say a prayer before I meet with anyone, whether it's on a weeknight or on a Sunday or whatever, because I don't know what's right for some people, but you know, our Savior does. Our Heavenly Father knows what they need. He knows what is going to affect change in their life, and He knows what things they need to hear in order to maybe make some connections that help them get through suffering or sadness or money problems or illness or whatever it is. And so I think really taking time to understand where people are coming from and just seeking out what it is Heavenly Father wants you to say is, for me, has been the most important thing.
So when you say, you know, it's not making assumptions that you understand exactly what they're going through, or that you understand all the pain points, and therefore let me talk you through this.
Yeah. Type of, well, and even, you know, as you mentioned at the beginning, I've helped a lot of people with planning funerals, and I've presided at quite a few funerals, and I've spoken at a lot of those funerals. And when I go over to talk to families about, you know, getting ready for the funeral, you know, I have kind of a checklist that I go through. And it was actually, my dad actually made the checklist when he was a bishop. And I just kind of take it. And it's kind of the, you know, the A, B's and C's of when you're doing a funeral. These are all things you need to think about. Wow. And which has been very helpful for me, because I go in and I say, you know, like I've come over right after someone's passed away, and, you know, like I'm there with the widow and she doesn't know what to do. And so, you know, the beginning of the checklist is basically, who do you call? You know, who needs to show up to the house? You know, if there's a certain way in which somebody's died, you know, sometimes the police have to be there to just make sure that there's, you know, especially if it's natural causes, that they can kind of check that off and say, you know, we just need the coroner to come. And I've gotten, you know, I'm very familiar with a lot of the funeral homes in the area and even outside of our area, and, you know, costs for funerals. And, you know, I've had some people that have done cremation and kind of what's involved in that. And I talked to them a lot about family members that they should probably contact and let know what's going on. I've called a lot of family members, you know, when their father or mother or brother has passed away. And then, you know, just kind of going through and talking to them about, as a person who's just lost a family member, what are your rights when you go to, you know, when the body's taken to the funeral home, and, you know, what can you expect from the whole process? You know, how long is it going to take, and when can you see your family member, and when can you dress them, and what's usually covered in a funeral and what's not, you know? And like, you know, sometimes you go to, well, not sometimes, you go to a funeral home and they've got packages for everything. You know, you got this package and, you know, it has like releasing doves or butterfly, you know, all this kind of stuff, which, you know, hey, it's great if that's what they want to do. But, you know, there's a lot of things they add into it that people don't have to do.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you haven't done it before, then, you know, it's all kind of new. And you're like, well, what, you know, do I need to do this? You know, do I need to have a limo come pick me up or all that stuff? And then, you know, I go through like just the setup of how a funeral would go. You know, who's going to speak? What prayers do you want? What kind of songs do you want? You know, I've been to a few funerals where it was kind of, you know, it was an open forum, almost like a testimony meeting, which is, I don't think ever a good idea at a funeral. unless you plan on being there for 4 or 5 hours, but, you know, just kind of talking to them about the limitations of what, you know, a funeral should be, especially if it's in a chapel at one of our churches. So I don't know. That's kind of a general overview, I guess, of what it is, but it's about four or five pages long. Yeah. It's really, really helpful.
Wow. Well, yeah, I'd love to, put it with this, interview, and if bishops want to download and adjust accordingly to fit their own circumstances or,
you know,
location, that'd be awesome. And it sounds like, I mean, going back to your experience where you talk about this numbness that you felt, I'm sure everybody that loses a loved one goes through a time of kind of shock and numbness. And sometimes the bishop can play the role of not necessarily doing the thinking or feeling, but just say, you know, I'm sure it's so refreshing for them to have a bishop there that's saying, hey, you know what? I know what to do next. Mm-hmm. You know, this is what I've seen. Or, you know, we have option A and option B. Mm-hmm. Like, what are you thinking here? Like, this is what I've seen in the past, right? And just that having somebody there that's going to, you know, host the funeral, for lack of a better term, you know, and preside at the funeral and be there, that they're sort of guide them through, because sometimes that numbness, they can just sort of wander,
right,
I imagine, in the situation and not move things forward as efficiently and quickly as maybe need to be moved.
Well, and I think it alleviates a lot of the stress that they could feel, you know, and I know that there's some people I've gone to, like, just, I mean, towards the end of the year, we had a member of our ward that passed away, and he had suffered with an illness most of his life. And it was, you know, it was eventually what led to his passing. But, you know, when I got there before any of his children were there. I was over there with his wife, just right after she had kind of found him. And, you know, I mean, she told me later on, she says, it was really good to have you come in and not push anything on me, you know, just kind of be there with me for a little while. And then to kind of know what to do next and to offer that to me. And I think that, you know, there's been some times where I've, I've had people where I've talked to them and I'm like, wow, they, you know, this person really shouldn't have to deal with this right now. And I'll talk to their children about it instead, you know, because they seem to be handling it a little bit better. And I'll kind of go over the stuff with them and say, hey, you know, when your mom's feeling up to it, you know, this is something that you should look at. And a lot of times I'll give them that checklist and say, hey, you know, when you're ready to do this, it's right here. And I'm more than happy to come back and walk through it with you. But, you know, however I can help.
The last question I have is one I typically ask, but maybe we can ask it in different contexts. As you look back at your, you know, now 3+ years of serving as bishop, and, you know, I think every bishop goes through their own set of trials. Some are quite traumatic, like yours, and others are maybe in the day-to-day and balancing and the demands that come at an individual or not. How has this process of leading and continuing to lead through tragedy made you a better follower of Jesus Christ?
I think that I've really come to understand how fully he knows what everyone is going through. Not that I understand that, but that I've really come to see that my own personal experience is not what counts. You know, I mean, it certainly helps and it makes things smoother when I've had experience in an area, but there's so many things that as a leader, especially I think as a bishop, that you deal with that you don't have personal experience with and that you don't really know how the person's feeling or what they're going through, that the Savior, he knows what all of that is. He knows how it feels. He knows how to fix it. He knows what kind of things will prepare us to deal with trials we're going to face. And a lot of times I think that we have these trials in our life that are preparing us for other things, even if we don't really truly know what they are yet. One of my 18-year-old daughter has had cerebral palsy her whole life, and she doesn't really talk. She has a very difficult time walking or getting around. You know, my wife and I bathe her and, you know, dress her and help her, feed her and do all that kind of stuff. She's not a normal 18-year-old. And I remember when she was little, she just didn't progress like other kids. And for a long time, we didn't know why she wasn't progressing. And, you know, you had other kids that were born around the same time as her, even kids that were born after her. And they were getting up and walking around and they were starting to talk. And, you know, there's a certain degree of sadness and loss that comes through seeing other people's kids progress and yours is not. And I think that after losing my oldest daughter, I had a lot of the same feelings when she passed. And especially over the last couple of years, well, as the last year or so, as she's had friends of hers that have gone on missions and come back, have started to get married, go off to college, you know, continue on with their life. And there's that feeling of kind of loss and, you know, and I feel better prepared to deal with it because I had to deal with that in a different kind of way, but I had to deal with it with my other daughter earlier on in our marriage. And I see more of that in my life. Like I see connections between things that are going on and trials that I face and things that happen a little further down the line. And I know that there'll be things that will happen, you know, further down in my life that I'm being prepared for right now. And I maybe don't even realize it. You know, I probably don't realize it. But that's what the Savior does for us is he, you know, and that's what our Heavenly Father does for us. He knows, at least in some degree, what lies ahead and how best to help us if we'll pay attention to the things they're kind of putting in our way to get us ready for what's to come. And I'm very grateful for that knowledge.
Wow. Bless your heart, Bishop Jim Hastings. Appreciate you coming on the Leading LDS podcast and allowing me to throw some difficult questions at you. And I hope everybody benefited from this. You know, I'm second guessing some of the questions I asked and how I asked them. And maybe I could have asked this way. And, you know, what about this thing? But I hope you gained a new perspective out of this. And my hope is that by listening to this, we're not just trying to, you know, relive some of these tragic things or talk about them just to talk about them. But I hope that somewhere there's a bishop, somewhere there's a Relief Society president who has to go over to a member's home tonight who has just experienced tragedy. And maybe from listening to this interview and listening to Bishop Hastings' perspective and experience, that you have a better idea how to approach it and a better way of how to serve them and support them. That is my prayer. So please share this and with other leaders that may benefit from it as well. And don't forget, visit leadinglds.org/teach to check out the 3 most viewed sessions from the recent Teaching Saints Virtual Summit. Until next time, be a leader and not a calling.
It came as a result of the position of leadership which was imposed upon us by the God of heaven, who brought forth a restoration of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And when the declaration was made concerning the only true and living church upon the face of the earth, we were immediately put in a position of loneliness. The loneliness of leadership, from which we cannot shrink nor run away, and to which we must face up with boldness and courage and ability.